They have published some of the most well-known authors in the Southern movement, from the Kennedy brothers to Jimmy Cantrell. Pelican Publishing Company has an incredibly diverse library of over 1,300 titles to their credit, with about 60 new titles published annually. If you like books about history, literature, humor, Cajun cooking, travel, or just about anything else, Pelican's website, ePelican.com, is the place for you. With online catalogs and secure online shopping, it's never been easier to tap into the wealth of knowledge and reading pleasure that Pelican has to offer. At ePelican.com, you can browse all of the Pelican's titles and shop for just the right book for yourself or a gift for someone else. Treat yourself today. Visit ePelican.com. That website again, ePelican.com.
All right, welcome to another live program here at Dixie Broadcasting. And as we do many Wednesday nights, we have a Pelican Pages interview here on Dixie Broadcasting with another author published by Pelican. And we're going to talk to an author tonight who has written a book about a real good bad guy. So everyone who's a fan of Southern heritage and Southern history, you got a real good bad guy to read about in the book that we're going to discuss tonight. Our author is none other than Robert Collins. He is a resident of Kansas and does a lot of writing and things about regional history there in the Kansas area. And Robert, we just want to thank you for being on the show and welcome to the program.
It's good to be here. It's especially good to be on a night where we do not have any thunderstorms barreling through Kansas.
Yeah, from what I understand, that's kind of a rarity lately.
Yeah, and they had a couple of funnel clouds sighted out by Greensburg over this past weekend. That gave those folks quite a scare, but fortunately it's all nice and quiet, of course, until the next storm system comes barreling through it, but that time of year.
Well, I guess when everything's as flat as it is out there, once it gets started, there ain't too much to stop it, is there?
Well, we're not quite that flat, but yeah, it's that season, you know, it's our storm season, but then our storm season is followed by wheat harvest, so it all works out, I guess.
Well, Robert, if you would get us started by just telling us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and how you became interested in history and writing about history.
Well, I'm a native Kansan. My family on my mother's side were some of the original settlers of the eastern Sedgwick County area, just east of Wichita. So I sort of had a little bit of that in my blood, although I started out writing science fiction and fantasy, which I still do and still love, and in fact was at a convention in Kansas City this past weekend and meeting a lot of nice people. And I sort of backfell into writing about local tourism, and that led to writing about railroad tourism, which led to railroad history, which leads to Kansas history, and my biography of Jim Lane.
And I guess the history of the railroads there in Kansas definitely played a major role in their historical development overall, didn't it?
Oh, yes. Railroads were key to Kansas being settled. Of course, one of my favorite railroads is the Kansas Pacific. That's the one where all the cattle were driven up the trail to Abilene, too. And there are a lot of interesting railroad stories, railroad towns, railroad companies, railroad rivalries. So, I've found quite a bit to write about.
Well, folks, we're talking to Robert Collins tonight, and we're talking about a book that he has out now with Pelican Publishing entitled Jim Lane, Scoundrel, Statesman, Kansan. And, Robert, I guess tell us a little bit about how you became interested with the character Jim Lane, and then we'll talk in a little more detail in just a few minutes about who he actually was.
Well, I've always had a sort of slight interest in the territorial period. I am trying to move away from the term bleeding Kansas. Having done some research, it really doesn't seem to have been that bleeding. So I'm speaking more of the territorial period these days. Always had a bit of an interest in that period, and in reading some of the more recent histories, Lane pops up, but nobody had really done much about him. And it sort of struck me that maybe there's a story, a biography in there, in trying to figure out who he was and what he did and how his story fits into the founding of Kansas and that sort of thing. And it also fits into an interest I've had for quite a while in the Civil War. Not a hugely passionate interest, but an interest nevertheless. And it seemed like a good opportunity to dive into the material and see what I could find, and see if I could find anything new, or at least something that hasn't been talked about before.
Sure. Now, for the listeners out there that may not be familiar with the story of Kansas and the things that went on there prior to the war, give the listeners a little bit of an idea of what was going on, because the truth is Kansas was of sorts a microcosm of what was to come all across the continent, pretty much. Is that right?
Yeah. The phrase that I've sort of popped into my head recently was, if you call the Civil War the big explosion, the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act is the lit match, and what happened in Kansas territory was the long fuse that set off the explosion.
Mm.
It was essentially an effort to settle Kansas either as a free state or as a slave state. And up to that point, it had been thought that no slave states would be admitted north of the southern border of Missouri. And when the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed, it had a provision allowing for popular sovereignty, the idea that the settlers would be able to vote on that and in theory could overturn the Missouri Compromise of 1820. And it just lit the spark.
Mm.
Soon the territory was flooded with people who were on one side or the other, and slowly but surely things at first got out of hand, but then they got in hand as, well, sort of the story of the Civil War, the more populous North won out.
And of course you had... I'm supposing a pretty good-sized population already there at the time of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, but then you had people flooding into the state, still looking for that good farmland, but also coming in for political reasons, too, I guess, from both sides.
Well, actually, there wasn't much of a population in Kansas when the Act was passed.
Oh, really?
In fact, one of the interesting oddities was that... they sort of passed the act before any federal surveys of the land had been completed. Up to that point, Kansas, present-day Oklahoma, Nebraska were all viewed as the permanent Indian frontier. Most of the Indian tribes who had lived east of the Mississippi had been relocated to those states. And the idea was that, well, nobody's ever going to settle this thing called the Great American Desert. And so... just move the Indians there and not worry about it. But of course people began to figure out, well, this wasn't such a desert after all, and there began some pressure to open Kansas and Nebraska to white settlement. And Stephen Douglas, hoping to advance his Chicago Railroad interests, had long taken up the cause. And then he met Senator David Acheson of Missouri, who wanted Kansas opened up as a slave state, and thus the whole tale begins.
Well, tell us a little bit about who Jim Lane was, and from where did he originate?
Well, Jim Lane came from Indiana. He was the son of an important Democratic politician. He was a veteran of the Mexican War, served at the Battle of Buena Vista, was a rising politician, and was elected to Congress, where he was one of the Democrats who cast his vote for the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and that seemed to have ended his political career in Indiana. So he relocated to Kansas. And in relocating, he became part of what we now call the Westerners. Those people who came to Kansas from what we now probably call the Western Great Lakes states, to some degree Western Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, also from Ohio, from Iowa, excuse me, and also, oddly enough, from the South. And these Westerners were different than the New England abolitionists, who usually think of as the usual pro-slavery adversaries in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
The Westerners were wanted Kansas to be a free state, but they had no moral view of slavery. They viewed slavery as unfair economic competition to hired labor on farms. They viewed plantation owners as being somewhat anti-democratic, in that in their experience in certain areas of the South, if all the plantation owners of a certain county or region were all Democrats, then everybody had to support the Democratic Party. If they were all Whigs, everybody had to support the Whig Party. And these Westerners had taken a very great interest in democracy and in the back and forth of politics, and they didn't like the idea of people telling you who to vote for. And they also viewed slavery as opposed to American free market capitalism and progress. They would point to the South and say, see, they don't have enough railroads. They don't have enough public schools. They aren't investing in town speculation. This is how we Westerners make our money. This is how we embrace the American dream. And do we really want that in Kansas? So this is how the Westerners viewed slavery, and Lane became, especially when he arrived in 1855 and for the next year or so, their chief spokesman and their chief representative in the major political meetings that occurred in Kansas over that next year and a half.
Now, Lane himself was quite an orator, from what I understand from reading your book.
Yes, he was certainly without a doubt the most powerful speaker in Kansas. He may have been one of the most powerful speakers in the nation at the time. There are all sorts of anecdotes of him giving amazing speeches and his amazing abilities. It was said that he could go to a meeting of 500 men, 250 of which were ready at the beginning of the meeting to hang him there and then. And by the end of this, by the end of his speech, he would have them all wanting to nominate him for whatever office he wanted, including President of the United States.
Yeah, that's a pretty powerful speaker.
Yes, and he was apparently very good at tailoring his speeches to whatever audience he was listening to. Early on in the book, I note that Lane was once giving a talk in one Kansas town, and one pro-slavery man began to interrupt him, and Lane stepped down and said, you're challenging me, so I know the Southern Code, so step off at 10 paces. And even though apparently he was probably born in Indiana, not across the river in Kentucky, but again, sometimes he would claim, if he had a largely southern audience, that he was from Kentucky. Other times he would claim he was from Indiana. But he could also go out on the frontier, speak rugged to the frontiersman, but then he could go to New York or Boston and, as the phrase went, whine through his nose like the best Boston brayman.
He certainly sounds like some politicians that sound familiar today. Now, so Lane himself was actually a free soiler, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. His first political movement in Kansas was to organize a Northern Allied Democratic Party. His problem was that by then, those Democrats who still called themselves that in Kansas were ardently pro-slavery, and everybody else had already moved into the Free State movement. So he quickly abandoned that and joined the regular Free State movement and quickly became one of its two key leaders.
Hmm. Well, folks, we're talking to Robert Collins about his book with Pelican Publishing entitled Jim Lane, Scoundrel, Statesman, Kansan. And when we come back in just a minute after a short break, we're going to talk more to Robert about Jim Lane, and you'll find out a little bit about his connections to Lincoln and his role there in the statehood of Kansas. And who knows, maybe we can get Robert to give us a few of the little tidbits of the things that made him a scoundrel. And so all you good Southerners out there, stick around. Don't go anywhere. There'll be plenty of good stuff to hate about this bad guy when we come back in just a minute. A famous writer once said, "Talent alone cannot make a writer. There must be a man behind the book, by birth and quality." As the only major Southern publishing house, Pelican Publishing believes that there is something valuable about our Southern way of life, about who we are, and about this place we call home, something worth putting down in written word on the printed page for future generations. Pelican Publishing is proud of our contribution to helping preserve the history and heritage and culture of the South, and we welcome submissions from authors new and experienced here at Pelican. Our family of authors includes some of the best-known names in Southern heritage today, plus a whole lot more. So whether it's about history or heritage, travel or trees, cooking or culture in general, if it's about the South, Pelican should be your first choice. Visit our website at epelican.com to find out about submitting your own book for consideration. Pelican Publishing, giving Southern authors a better choice. All right, welcome back to this Pelican Pages segment. We're talking to Robert Collins about his new book with Pelican entitled Jim Lane, Scoundrel, Statesman, Kansan. By the way, you can take a look at this book and the other book that we're going to talk just briefly about with Robert tonight that's published by Pelican by going to the Pelican website at epelican.com. And when you go to the website there, there will be a little tab at the top that says search or browse. And you can click on that and type in either part of the title of the book about Jim Lane, or you can type in the author's name, Robert Collins, and it'll pull the book up for you. You can actually read a short segment on the book there at the Pelican website, and you can even purchase it at a reduced price from the Pelican website. So we encourage you to take a look at that book on the Pelican website, even while we're talking about it on the program. Now, Robert, we've kind of thrown it out there a little bit. Tell us what the connection was between Jim Lane and old Abe Lincoln.
Well, they were both moderate politicians who came to the Republican Party from different parties. Lane was a diehard Democrat. As I mentioned earlier, his father was a key figure in the Democratic Party back in his home state of Indiana. They were both fairly tall men. Lane was probably about 2 inches shorter than Lincoln. Both, as one Kansas historian described them, both kind of homely-looking fellows. And both.
Now you know that we Southerners just we just call Lincoln flat out ugly.
But both both were not terribly radical in their sentiments on slavery. They were both fairly moderate. They were both opposed to slavery, but neither were particularly abolitionist in sentiment, especially compared to the traditional New England abolitionists that helped found the Republican Party. Lane did have a somewhat close relationship to Lincoln. Lincoln found him politically useful. It's interesting to note that Lane, as early as the fall of 1861, was calling for an Emancipation Proclamation, yet Lane also in 1864, as Lincoln was running for re-election, spoke out to the abolitionists who wanted to dump Lincoln because he hadn't issued the proclamation fast enough or made it apply everywhere. Lane saying, who else would have the political savvy to issue it at the right time, when the public was ready, and, you know, this is the mark of a good politician and a good leader, to not be too far ahead of public sentiment, but not to be following the public sentiment either.
Well, what was the role that Jim Lane played in the whole statehood process there in Kansas? Because I know if there's one thing that really makes him stick out as far as political accomplishments, that was probably it.
Well, he was key in bringing the two factions, the abolitionists and the Westerners, together into a united free state movement. And my feeling is that in bringing this movement together and giving it political strength over time, in getting it in 1857 to participate in the territorial elections and taking control of the territorial government, helped to assure that Kansas would become a free state. It wasn't always a given that Kansas would become a free state, but eventually the majority sentiment willed out, and Lane was very important in bringing that movement together, in using his speaking ability to rally people to whatever cause the free state movement needed, especially in that 1857 election, and in helping bring Kansas into the fold.
Now, Robert, I know this is kind of a controversial question, but I know that there are a number of books and even documentaries that have been produced that more or less state that there were many people who came in to Kansas, some just for temporary sake and some who stayed, that were specifically brought in for that vote on the statehood and on the slavery free soil issue. Was Jim Lane in any way involved with trying to get folks in for that, and what was his role in that, if any?
Well, it seems his only major role in that came in the summer of 1856, and it was more of a great propaganda coup. In May of that year, Lane happened to be the only member of the Free State Movement who was not in Kansas Territory and thus avoided being arrested for treason by the pro-slavery territorial authorities. And he gave a rather powerful speech in Chicago. And at the end of the speech, people spontaneously began giving him money and guns and saying, let's rally and help these poor Kansans who are under the threat of this oppressive territorial government. And that ended up, not coincidentally, into the Kansas Aid Societies that sprung up that summer. Well, Lane founded this trail called the Lane Trail to avoid free soil settlers from having to go up the Missouri River and through Missouri and getting attacked by the Missourians. So he finally comes back to Kansas in the middle of the summer of 1856, but it's not with what everybody thought, Lane's army, you know, thousands of free soil soldiers, but with a few hundred ordinary settlers.
Okay.
But it turned out to be a very good propaganda coup. It scared the heck out of the pro-slavery faction, and that was pretty much Lane's contribution, was the Lane Trail, which was used for a time in 56 and 57 to help northern settlers avoid Missouri.
And, of course, the Missouri bushwhackers, being good Southerners, they were doing their part to keep the Yankee settlers from moving into Kansas at the time. Now,
but one of the funny things that a lot of people, and what I found out researching this book and my next one about the period, is that there were quite a few Missourians who were themselves free soilers who settled in Kansas. In fact, Davy Atchison's great political opponent in the Democratic Party, Thomas Hart Benton, opposed the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and one of the chief newspaper men for the Free Soil Movement actually came, I believe, from South Carolina, of all places. Like I said, it was more not so much a moral movement as a political movement, and it came from all quarters.
And a lot of it, like you said, based upon financial considerations, it sounds.
Mm-hmm. More on the politics of the day, more on the embracing of what was the growing free market capitalism of America, rather than simply saying this is immoral and we must wipe it out. As I say, most free soil settlers in Kansas had no interest in abolishing slavery where it was. they simply didn't want it coming to Kansas.
Mm-hmm. Now, all of our Southern listeners, Robert, undoubtedly are waiting for you to give us some of the things, some of the dirt on Jim Lane that gives us the right to call him a scoundrel and not feel bad about it. So tell us whatever you want to tell us to whet our appetite. We certainly don't expect you to give away the whole book here, but tell us a few tidbits to whet our appetite.
Well, Lane certainly was a politician, and he was a typical politician of his day, which meant he was a patronage politician. And that often meant handing out political jobs to those who supported him. When I was up at my science fiction convention this past weekend, I did two readings, one for my new novel and one from the Lane book. And when Lane was up for re-election in 1864, he managed to promise a federal marshalship to about 17 separate members of the Kansas legislature. And then when they all came to his apartment in Washington to demanding the job, he gathered them together one night and said, "You know, you gentlemen should have voted for me out of the need to put me back into the Senate and to do good for the nation, not out of your own selfish greed for this post. I deem you all unworthy, and I'll nominate somebody else." He was also...
I'm sure that went over well back home.
History does not record what the 17 men said, but they probably did were a little hurt, and then afterwards they got over it. He was that sort of a fellow. Certainly he wasn't as a free soiler, wasn't interested in the rights of slaves. Although once the Civil War came, he began to argue rather passionately that the Union war effort ought to be directed at slavery, not just at restoration of the Union. And there is the incident still controversial about the sack of Osceola, Missouri. There are a few Missourians who insist that dozens or hundreds were killed, the town was burned to the ground, women pillaged and buildings raped or whatever. It wasn't really that bad. There were quite a few buildings that were destroyed. There were maybe a half dozen to a dozen people killed, mainly in a skirmish, as Lane's men rode up to the town. And this was at the beginning of the Civil War.
Now, I have to tell you, I'm probably going to have phone calls or emails coming in, because I know we have some Missourians that listen, and to this day they feel just as strongly about that as probably folks felt back then about that particular incident that happened.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. I actually got an email from somebody insisting, "How dare I write about Jim Lane because he did this terrible thing at Osceola." And, well, what can you say? The historical record says that it wasn't that much. And also, it was a very important lead mining town. And, of course, lead is very important in the manufacture of bullets.
Yeah.
So, and Lane was just sort of a rapscallion character. Like I said, sometimes making promises he couldn't keep, sometimes handing out offices. He tried to make himself a general while a senator, and when the Union soldiers wouldn't go, Union generals wouldn't go along with it, he slunk back to Washington. But I always found that as sometimes dodgy as what Lane was sometimes up to, his political opponents, especially his Republican opponents, were even dodgier.
Mm. Now, he had a reputation for being somewhat of a womanizer, is that correct?
Actually, no.
No?
What I found was that he did get divorced in 1856, although it seems that his wife had divorced him not so much because of any womanizing, but more because she was afraid of being married to someone who the territorial authorities considered a seditious traitor and an enemy to their government.
Gotcha.
There were very few substantiated allegations that were ever raised against him. To some degree, the darkened reputation that Lane has gotten in history was not so much from Southerners, but from the New England abolitionists, who resented the idea that this fellow who was not an abolitionist had more to do with making a Kansas free state than their champion, Charles Robinson, our first governor, had. In fact, Robinson carried on a feud with Lane for about 30 years after Lane had died. So, yeah, it's one of those things where people, you know, really didn't react well to this idea of this moderate politician playing an important role in what they thought was their moral crusade.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know things didn't end up quite like you would think they would end up for a man that seems to have played such a prominent role in a state's history as Jim Lane did. Tell us how it all ended up there.
Well, it's very sad. At the beginning of 1866, Lane had always allied himself with more powerful politicians, and after Lincoln's assassination, he naturally gravitated towards President Johnson. But Lane was also a small P populist, and those leanings would have pulled him more towards the radical Republicans in Congress. And over the year following Lincoln's assassination, he became more and more torn, to the point at which he first agreed to uphold Johnson's veto of a civil rights bill, but then found out that that was an extremely unpopular move in Kansas, and actually went to Johnson and begged to be let out of this promise, and Johnson said absolutely not. And Lane had to cast this vote to uphold this veto, which he really did not want to do. And, of course, the radicals attacked him. They invented a phony scandal. Slowly, he seems to have sunk into a sort of depressive spiral in which he didn't see any way to resolve the conflict between who he should choose, Johnson or the radical Republicans. And it took a horrible toll on him. He was barely well enough to travel back home to as far as St. Louis. Finally made it to Leavenworth, Kansas, not back to his home in Lawrence, but made it back to Leavenworth, and then one morning got up and took a carriage ride, and then stepped out of the carriage and said to the fellows he was riding with, "Goodbye, gentlemen," pulled out a pistol he had smuggled, and put the pistol in his mouth and pulled the trigger.
Wow.
But then the extraordinary thing was Lane actually lived for 11 days after that.
Oh, my goodness.
In fact, I found newspaper articles that were speculating that there was some possibility that although he might not completely recover his faculties, he might just survive the wound.
Wow, that would have been an awful thing.
Yes, it was. But he was an enormously strong person, a strong constitution. But in the end, it did end his life, and he died July the 11th, 1866.
And today there in Kansas, is Jim Lane well-known, well-remembered? And if so, in what way is he typically remembered by the average Kansan?
Sadly, the average Kansan does not know much about Jim Lane.
So goes the history with most of our state leaders in most of our states, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah. Our bleeding Kansas, our territorial period history, has been sort of simplified into the abolitionists versus the pro-slavery faction, and the abolitionists won. And if Lane pops up at all, it's as some sort of wild man skulking through the period, sort of like John Brown, only without as many casualty figures in Lane's hand as with Brown's. Although we are paying a bit more attention to our bleeding Kansas heritage and to the territorial story, and several counties in Kansas and in Missouri have been declared national heritage areas, and we are trying to preserve what we can. So there is some hope that we'll be able to get the full story and to pass it along to those who ought to know the full story and ought to understand what happened here and how that led to the awful tragedy of the Civil War.
Well, folks, if you're listening and you're a Southerner, obviously you're listening to Dixie Broadcasting, so you must be a Southern sympathizer if you're not a Southerner. But if you're looking for somebody that you'd like to nail to the wall as a bad guy and you'd like to find out more information about him, it's a book just chocked full of information about a man that there really hasn't been very much written about before, Jim Lane. And we've been talking to Robert Collins tonight about his book, Jim Lane, Scoundrel, Statesman, Kansan. You can take a look at it on the Pelican website there at epelican.com. Now, before we finish out tonight, Robert, if you would, tell us a little bit about the other book that you already have published with Pelican.
Ah, yes. That book is called General James G. Blunt, Tarnished Glory. Blunt was Kansas's highest-ranking and most important Civil War general. He was a bit of a lame man, although Blunt was, to some degree, his own man. He was a very good Civil War general, won a lot of victories, was a very key player in some of the battles that were fought out in this region. But he was an extremely unpleasant person. I would say about Lane, even Southerners can sort of say, well, he was a bit of a rapscallion, but in the end, he was always trying to follow the public will. Blunt was a complete, how shall I put it, complete sleazebag. This is a fellow that got rich off the military supply system. This is a fellow who had trouble taking orders from superiors because they weren't as dedicated abolitionists as he was. This is a fellow who feuded with just about every general and quite a few politicians, including Lane himself. General Grant made the his one observation about Blunt, that he seemed to be a very contentious person.
So he fits the typical Yankee stereotype that most of us Southerners have.
Blunt was sort of worse.
Oh, no.
He was a fellow who could fight a really good battle and then complain to you because somehow somebody didn't give him the proper credit or didn't spell his name right or something like that. I've been asked about, well, you're going to write about some of these other people in the period, and not really interested, and they've mentioned some other names, and I was like, well, I've already written one biography about a person who I didn't like at the end of the book, so I'm not going to do that again. I really, having written his biography, I have to say I really don't like Blunt all that much. He was a good general, but just a very bad person, and I keep wanting to, you know, to go back through history, grab the man by the lapels, and say, what the hell were you thinking?
Now, how did you choose to come? How did you come to choose Pelican as your publisher for these two books?
There lies a good tale. I first approached Pelican with the Blunt book, and as it happened, it was sort of there for about a year and a half, and nothing really happened. And then, in following up. I was told after about a year and a half, well, the editor is going on a European vacation, but in a few months, send a two-page query letter. So I sent the two-page query letter, and within a few months, I had the contract.
Wow.
So, and then the Lane book was especially nice and kind of touching. Blunt came out in the summer of 2005, and, of course, as everybody knows, not long after that, Hurricane Katrina struck the New Orleans area.
Right.
And a week after Pelican got back up and running again, I was talking to the sales guy who helps me with getting some of my speaking engagements, book signings set up, and I mentioned that I had finished this biography of Jim Lane. I told him a little bit of who Lane was. But I told them, look, you guys are just getting back up and running. I've queried another publisher. Don't really worry about it. But he said, well, I'll mention it to at the meeting we're having tomorrow, and I'll just bring it up anyway. Well, that's okay. So I'm out of the house that very next day, and there's a message on my answering machine from him saying, I talked about the Lane book to everybody, and we were wondering if you could not query the other publisher and query us instead. And I just thought, oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
So I sent them the query, and within a few months had the contract. It did have to be cut down quite a bit. The initial Lane manuscript was about 150,000 pages and had to be cut down by about a third.
Wow.
But a lot of that material has gone into a new manuscript that I've submitted to Pelican on the political struggle to make Kansas a free state. My title for it is Vote We Must. I don't know if that'll keep or not, but I wanted to follow up with the Lane book and follow that political movement, that political struggle, and to identify the events, identify more of the people, and sort of say, here's how it happened. Here's how the movement came together. Here are the key events, including some events that often, when you read books about Bleeding Kansas or Kansas Territory, sort of get passed over, and yet they're very important to the story.
Right. So that manuscript is currently sitting with Pelican then?
I just sent a query off to the editor last week, so cross your fingers, we'll see what happens. I'm hopeful. Pelican has been very nice to me, and I want to keep publishing with them. It's very good to have a publisher who will help you out with some book signings, even if only about a third of your events come through them. Helpful with media. I've worked with some small press publishers, and I have to say, often the author has to do a lot of stuff himself. It's really very hard, and it takes up a lot of time and effort, so it's always nice if your publisher is willing to do a little bit of that. Of course, the author is always the best salesman for his book.
Sure.
So authors should go out and sell their books themselves, but it's nice to have a good relationship with the publisher.
And that is probably the one thing that I hear from the authors with Pelican more than anything else, is that Pelican does do more than most publishers in actually trying to help promote the books once they're actually published.
Yes, yes. And having a good PR person helps, having a salesperson who has a good relationship with stores, having them willing to have the author, go into some of these places, for the first time and say, hey, I've got this book out, and then here's the phone number, and have somebody call somebody and get them books. That's really great.
That's good.
Yeah, and of course, I know Pelican is kind of hustling because the Lane biography is a $30 book, and you kind of need to hustle those. But it's really good, and some of us up here in Kansas are hoping they'll expand a little bit more into our neck of the woods as far as history goes, because we just don't have a publisher here who's really interested and enthusiastic about Kansas history. We have University Press of Kansas, but unless you're already published by them, you're not going to get published by them.
I know how that works. Now, other than the manuscript that's already with Pelican, anything else that maybe you're mulling around as far as a historical context, or maybe some of the other things you want to mention?
Well, I would be remiss for my publisher of my novel, who, by the way, is living in Virginia. The novel is called Expert Assistance. It's a funny science fiction novel. Has nothing to do with the South or with rebellions. Well, it has something to do with rebellions, but it's more satirical and fun than anything else. So take a look at that. It's published by Asylet Press, Asylett. As far as history goes, I've queried Pelican about this Vote We Must manuscript. also queried them about something called Kansas 1874. That was a very interesting year in Kansas history, a lot of transitions between the frontier and actually becoming the state of Kansas, our own individual identity as a state. And then I've got two big projects I'm working on. One is an update of my history of the Kansas Pacific Railroad. I did an illustrated history a long time ago, and now I want to do a more complete history of that railroad. And then the big opus that I'm starting to gather here in the state people are interested in is called Kansas County Seat Conflicts.
Hmm.
About all the various conflicts we had over where the county seat would be and all the town rivalries, and in a few cases some of the violence, including a few murders and that sort of mayhem.
Good stories.
Yeah, good. Well, it's
well, they make for good reading anyway.
Well, it's an aspect of the history of the West that we don't often hear about, yet it happened not just all over the West, but apparently all over the nation. Apparently, one of the first county seat struggles happened in 1750, and in Kansas, the last one ended in 1963. But, you know, the Lincoln County War with Bill as a kid, that, to some degree, was a county seat conflict. So, you know, it's important to sort of get into this aspect of Western history and to sort this out. And what I'm hoping is just getting the Kansas book done so that other people will research this phenomenon, because there isn't a whole lot out there on it right now, and yet it happened all over the place.
Well, Robert, it certainly looks like you're blazing a trail for Western history there, particularly in the Kansas area. So we appreciate all the research and history that went into the book we talked about tonight and your other books too.
All right.
And we'll look forward to hearing more from you when some of these other books are out and ready for us to talk about those on the air too. Folks, we've been talking to Robert Collins tonight about his book, Jim Lane, Scoundrel, Statesman, Kansan. And Robert, thanks again for being on the program.
Happy to have been here.
Well, folks, you can find out more about this book, and as we mentioned, you can actually purchase it online at a reduced price there at the Pelican website by going to epelican.com. Click on the Browse tab there at the top of the website and type in part of the title, Jim Lane, or you can type in the author's name, Robert Collins, and it'll pull the book up there, and you can actually purchase it at a reduced price on the website there at Pelican. You can actually probably find this in just about any of your major bookstores across the country. Just go in and look at the historical section, and you'll probably be able to find it. If they do not have it on the bookshelf, they can get it from Pelican for you probably in about 2 days' time. So we hope you'll take a look at that, and it certainly is a book that you'll find interesting from a Southern point of view about a good bad guy to take a poke at here and there. Well, folks, until next time on the next Pelican Pages segment, this is your host, Ray McBerry, and we're going to leave you with plenty more good Southern music all night long.